Session number 9407.
As Dwight Realto.
So I took this job, and it was, of course, the first regular sort of job I'd had, opportunity I'd had. And I went along with that. I managed to get myself onto machines eventually, drilling machines and other jobs. I taught myself to read a micrometer and a vernier and the elementary trigonometry. So this I taught myself. And I learned some more skills as a semi-skilled man. Until that time, I suppose, I'd hardly ever read a newspaper. There was no television, and I'd had very little access even to radio, especially in the Navy and in Australia and dodging around. I was completely apolitical in the sense of knowledge that way. But I had had the experience of seeing what went on in Malta, the attitude of the Navy and the British to the Maltese people, the way they were treated.
How was that?
Well, it's a long story again, but it's that somebody on the island of Malta, one of the Maltese, had, or a firm of them, had a contract with the Royal Navy to collect all the gash food from the ships, Navy vessels. They used to send their men on board for every meal with big kerosene cans with a yoke on their shoulders, and they'd come on, and they'd come onto the mess deck when we had our meal to collect all the leavings on the tables, all the peelings. In those days, it was the messing system was that the seamen did their own cooking and catering, and two had a rota, two on each mess deck or each mess would act as cooks for the week or a fortnight. And they would cater and take the stuff to be cooked, prepare it and take it to the galley to be cooked only and serve it and be responsible for clearing away the tables after. So these Maltese would come, and then they would come to the mess, and the cooks would give them all the everything there was, and it would all go in these tins. And they would carry this ashore. And that was boiled up and cooked in a kind of stew, which I think played a large part in the diet of dockyard workers, Maltese workers and people. It was absolutely shocking.
So these Maltese would sell it to them, would they?
Yes. At prices they could afford to pay, you see.
Which year was this?
This was in 1925 to 26. And I had rejected, when I was at school, I rejected religion, religious teaching and that sort of thing on the part of the teachers and the governor, who was the rector. I just couldn't take it.
Why not?
It was just meaningless to me. Meaningless, the whole thing. Going over and over the Old Testament. And it just didn't mean a thing. I couldn't accept it as logic at all. And I didn't like going into the church. I was dragged into church a few times.
By your parents?
No, not by my parents. They weren't religious, and they were apolitical as well. No, by the school governors and teachers. I resented it. Another thing I resented was that when we were being taught geography, we were actually given a book about Australia, which stated that things in Australia are upside down as to Britain. For example, trees shed their bark and not their leaves. Cherries have the stones outside. Well, I'm 7 years of age then, and that rocked me on my heels. So I queried this, challenged it. I said, I can't understand a cherry with a stone outside. Ah, this is the book which is used throughout the country and system and so forth. We had two spinsters teaching us all in one room in that village. You have to accept that. Who are you to challenge that statement? I said, well, I don't accept it. Of course, I got a caning, but it made no difference. I saw the poverty in the village. We weren't badly off, we weren't poverty stricken, but I saw the poverty in among the other villagers. This class distinction, the vicar and the manor and lord of the manor and some of the bigger farmers, and then the rest would. Why? I was always questioning why. Why unemployment about? Why this attitude and treatment within the Navy? Why this treatment of the Maltese people? I disliked it intensely. I didn't know why. I couldn't find the answer why or what could be done about it or anything. The same went all the way through. In Australia, I queried the whole thing. Why was it that especially English people going out there to Australia would be given a grant by the government to take a plot of land to farm? And they'd have to clear this plot of land, clear the scrub and everything. They'd get a grant to do that, to buy a team of horses and to do that and to sow a first crop. They had to pay 25% interest on that loan. And they were scratching away, and then they'd only have to have one of their horses in the team die or go ill or something, and they're up against it. They might get a reasonable crop the first year on the surface, but then they'd probably get rust. There'd be an epidemic of rust or something like that, and their crop could be wiped out practically. Or they might get away with it the first year, but the second year, and at least by the third year, living right on the land, you know, making their own, building their own little humpy and sleeping on a sacking, cooking very simply, open fire, grinding away from daylight to dusk. And then at the end, they'd be so much in arrears, they couldn't get further grants anymore, they couldn't repay their interest, so they'd be foreclosed and they're out. Then that plot of land would be sold to the next mugs. This was going on. Of course, most of the Australia's wheat was exported to Britain, especially. These people dominated the whole scene. The farmers who grew the wheat had to take it into the nearest railway sidings and sell it to this firm, literally. The firm decided the price. then they would ship it down to the docks and they would ship it over to Britain, fixing their price for Britain. Of course, depending on the... if there was a glut of wheat, it was a good year, then they would pay the farmers half or even less than half of what they would pay for that wheat to keep the wheat and burn it in the fields in order to keep the price up, because they didn't want too much stocks. And we were paying through the nose for it in Britain. The farmers were getting practically nothing. And the next year would be a bad year. Rust and all the rest of it. Then they'd pay a good price for the wheat at the railhead. But most of the farmers hadn't got the wheat then to sell it. That's what they were up against. This whole thing, this whole system that I could see working of it. Why is this? How and why this should be like that? I contested certain other things. There were very few tractors in Australia at that time. Very, very few. They were almost a novelty. Everything was done by horsepower. We drove teams of 8, 10, even 12 horses, one man in a plow. And all the other operations were teams of 6 horses with a wagon and 2 men to load the bags of wheat in the field on this flat top wagon and take it into the siding. I was driving one time 4 horse team with a seed box sowing. And the methods used, at the end of the runs, there were long runs we made. At the end of the run, a boy would go with a horse and tip cart and some half bags of wheat and superphosphate and dump them along. And then we would drive up from that end up to that end. And by then the boxes were empty. So we'd turn round, load the bags, seed and superphosphate onto the box, jump on the back, drive off, and then push it down through, not to lose any time. We had 2 hours for dinner for the horses. Otherwise, we were on from daylight to dark. And we managed 20 acres a day. Sowing like that, one man with 4 horses and the auxiliary help loading the lands. They got a tractor, the 2 brothers I was working for. They got in a tractor, an 8 horsepower tractor, to try it out. So they had 2 men, one man on the tractor, one man on the box at the back. Again, they had the stuff at the ends and the petrol, a paraffin, and they would drive up. Now, they never stopped for lunch or anything. They changed places on the tractor and ate their lunch standing on the back while they were going down, and they kept the thing going all the time, putting the cans of paraffin on the top of a funnel each time and let it drop down into the tank. And they managed 32 acres a day like that. They got 2 men wages. They'd got the cost of the tractor, the enormous cost of the repairs and upkeep of a tractor, and then in, say, 5 years' time, the cost, enormous cost of a replacement completely, as against the horses, which replace themselves practically. We used to replace them from the bush, go out and buy it, get some, round up some wild ones, semi-wild ones, and put them in the team and away. One man. You see, this was the sort of balance which I couldn't see the sense of at that time. Mechanization, the way it was applied as against other methods.
So how did your political ideas develop from all these formative experiences?
Well, when I got my first job in the factory, my brother-in-law had been interested in politics a while, and I was talking to him. I had not had much talk with him before. And I joined the trade unions when I went into this factory. Everybody else was in the trade union, and I joined the trade union, and I started to see what that was about.
Which trade union?
The AEU. I then went with my brother-in-law and my sister. We went to some lectures at Morley College. I was a German professor. And we had discussions about, and I heard about, for the first time, I heard about Marx and Lenin and communism.
What were the lectures on?
Philosophy, yes. But this lecturer was I found out he was a communist. He was a German professor. And of course, we got on to a lot of things in these discussions and lectures.
What was the name of the professor? Doesn't matter if you can't remember.
Gone now, immediately. That was my introduction to and I began to see then where all my experiences started to fit in. I began to get an explanation for these things, which I could never seemed to get before. Why they should be. Then, not only understanding why, what is and why, but what can be done about it, if anything can be done about it.
Which year would you have gone to these lectures?
This was in 1934. So in 1935, I joined the Communist Party.
How did you go about it?
With my brother-in-law and my sister, who had contacts with communists. They had made contact with some communists, and we applied to join. We were accepted, and we studied and that sort of thing, and learned. And
which branch did you join?
That was in Balham.
It was called the Balham branch of the Communist Party?
Yes.
And what kind of an organisation did they have at that time? Was it big?
Well, it was very small, locally, but they were very enthusiastic, very diligent, very well organised in there, the meetings and everything else.
Who were the leading lights in the organisation?
At that time, Palm Dutt, Isabel Brown, Harry Pollitt was, I'm not sure whether he was the General Secretary when we joined or when it was just after he became the Secretary.
No, I mean in the Balham Communist Party.
Oh, in the Balham Communist Party. Balham, we were linked up with Wandsworth, and the leading lights of the Balham and Tooting in Wandsworth were mainly Springhall, Dave Springhall, about whom you possibly have heard otherwise.
What do you mean you were linked up with Tooting and Wandsworth?
Well, we had sort of local branches. They were very small, only about half a dozen of us in Balham and another one in Tooting, and there were others in Wandsworth. But then we formed a sort of Wandsworth branch, main branch, for that area.
If it was called the Wandsworth branch, what was the Balham CP called?
Well, we called it the Balham group or branch.
But it was part of the Wandsworth branch?
Part of Wandsworth branch, yes. We worked with the other groups. And
what kind of people were in the Balham Communist Party? Were they workers or what?
Yes, the workers, teachers. There was an insurance agent one time. Post office workers, railway workers, and some other engineer, one or two engineering workers.
What kind of ages?
I think the minimum would have been about 20, 21, up to all ages above that.
So, but were they generally young or generally old?
It was a mixture, complete mixture.
Were they all men or did you have any women?
No, women as well.
Was it mostly men?
I think probably it was. A majority would have been men, but there were quite a number of women.
What size of membership would it have been? 10, 20 or what?
Of Balham, about, varied, I would say from 6 to possibly 12 over the period that I was there.
What activity did they conduct? Was it just a discussion group or was there any...
Oh no, we carried out activities, especially around elections in support of the Labour Party, although we didn't agree with the Labour Party as such, but we agreed to support them and get them into Parliament. And therefore, we conducted campaigns with the Labour Party workers and for the Labour Party, largely. We carried out campaigns in support of the German workers when Thälmann was imprisoned for his release against the black shirts, the Mosleyites, with at Cable Street. We were in the battles there against Mosley.
Did you personally go to Cable Street?
Yes, I was there.
What did you say?
In it. Well, there was a terrific mass of people everywhere, closely crowded, and in some streets all the dockers and the area and all the poor Jewish people and so forth all turned out on that day, that Sunday. Mosley had a meeting in the Minories, and he was to have marched in the afternoon from the Minories through to Cable Street through the East End. And there were such, and the police were trying to enforce a way through for him. But the whole area was absolutely packed with people. There were barricades up. Of course, there was a lot of, the police were, mounted police were charging with their horses. They were getting unshipped, tossed off their horses by the crowds. There were fights and scuffles. And, barricades, everything. But in 3 or 4 hours of that, the police were unable to open the way to allow Mosley to march through, and in the end he had to disappear from where he was the other way.
Where were you located at Cable Street?
I was at Cable Street on the corner of, I forget the name of the street now, there was a big shop. And we were there, right in the middle of it.
Did you go as a group?
Well, we met there, yes. Several of us went as a group from where we lived.
Was this from the Balham CP?
Yes, yes.
How many of you?
That went there?
From the in your group?
Oh, about 8, I think. Mm. Somewhere about 8.
Did you go with any banners or any weapons or anything of that kind?
No weapons, no banners, just some placards. Some of us had made placards.
Saying what?
Or down with Mosley and things like that, of course. Fight against fascism.
Do Did you actually see the Mosleyites from where you were?
No, not there. No, we couldn't see them from police.
Did you get involved in any violence?
Only in pushing and struggling at the time there, but close proximity to a policeman tossed off his horse and some others who were doing other things. You know, there are all sorts of things going on. I actually wasn't directly involved in any activity like that.
How did the policeman come off his horse?
Well, it was a technique that was devised. I don't know whether I should talk about it, really.
Why not?
It was a quite... Well, I don't know. You see, it was a simple thing that when you're being charged...